Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really digging into the career of a comedian who kind of perfectly shows the modern way to build success.
Yeah, blending that, you know, deep regional feel with a really smart digital approach.
We're unpacking the story of Amber Preston. And what makes her story so interesting, I think, is this like tension you see in the sources.
Uh-huh.
She gets called a top comedian to watch by, well, Marc Maron, a huge name, back in 2011.
Right, very early on.
But then, like, 7 years later, Thrillist calls her one of the best undiscovered comedians in America. And then she hits number one on the comedy charts. It's quite a path.
That contradiction, that's the perfect way in, isn't it? We've pulled together pretty much everything available on her career, you know, from her background, where she grew up, to the big successes.
Okay.
And our mission, really, is to trace how a performer builds that national name while staying, well, fiercely true to this very specific, very regional identity. We want to go beyond just like listing awards.
Right. More the strategy behind it all, how she made it last.
Exactly. The strategy.
Because when you just look at the basic facts, the story grabs you straight away. Born, raised in Fargo, North Dakota, makes the move to LA a big strategic step.
Mm-hmm.
And then her first album, Sparkly Parts, comes out in 2020 and boom, number one, both Amazon and iTunes comedy charts.
Yeah, the kind of immediate impact for a debut.
Yeah.
Especially after years plugging away, it suggests there was a real plan there, a carefully built thing.
Absolutely. And that's the plan we want to dissect today.
Okay, so where do we start? We'll begin right where her comedy often starts.
Yeah.
That solid Midwestern foundation.
The Fargo years. Minneapolis, too.
Exactly. And some pretty unexpected family ties that actually anchor her comedy. Then we'll look at defining her specific voice, how she uses those roots almost like a comedic tool.
And the critical praise she got along the way.
Right. And finally, we'll get into her major projects like that album Success and really analyze what seems to be the real engine of her rise.
Mm-hmm.
Her huge, very strategic presence online, especially in podcasts.
Okay, let's dive into that foundation. Because for Amber Preston, where she's from isn't just background info. It's like part of the character, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's fundamental. She grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, graduated West Fargo High in 96. The sources really stress how that Fargo identity is just, well, it's a core to what she does.
It grounds everything.
Yeah, the grounding element. So after high school, she does what a lot of creative folks in that area do, moves to Minneapolis, late 90s.
Which is a big step in itself.
Huge.
Right.
And crucial for two big reasons. First, she gets a theater degree there from the University of Minnesota. So she's building that formal performance skill set.
Okay.
Second, Minneapolis isn't just, you know, any city. It has one of the best regional comedy scenes in the U.S. Really vibrant, competitive, but also supportive.
So it let her really sharpen her stand-up skills.
Exactly. In a tough environment, but maybe without that intense immediate pressure you get in New York or L.A. right away.
And the sources show she didn't just, like, rush off to the coast. She spent years building that base in Minneapolis.
That's right. The big strategic move, the pivot, that came way later, 2014. That's when she moves from Minneapolis to L.A.
And specifically to focus on stand-up and acting.
Specifically, yeah.
So what does that tell you? Waiting almost two decades after high school, well after starting comedy, to make that jump.
It tells you she's playing the long game. She's being calculated.
Yeah.
You see so many comics, they just jump straight to L.A. or New York.
And burn out fast.
Often, yeah. Because maybe they haven't really found their voice yet, or they don't have a solid, you know, 45-minute set they can rely on.
Yeah.
Preston spent those years mastering the region, winning contests, getting good reviews locally.
Right.
So when she finally hit L.A. in 2014, she wasn't just like raw talent hoping someone would notice her. She was already a proven comic. She had a fully formed act. She had fans, even if they were mostly regional back then. It shows real professional maturity, I think.
Yeah. It's like the difference between going to L.A. to figure out how to do stand-up versus going there to really do stand-up professionally.
Precisely. But this whole deep connection to the Midwest, it brings us to one of the most surprising little details we found in the sources. Something that connects her to this, well, very specific part of American entertainment history.
Okay, I think I know where you're going. This is the Lawrence Welk connection, isn't it?
Bingo.
For our listeners who might not know, Lawrence Welk, the famous TV band leader, the accordion player, known for that wholesome champagne music and his, well, very distinct accent.
That's the one. And the sources confirm Amber Preston is actually related to him.
Which seems, you know, totally random for a modern stand-up comedian.
It does on the surface.
Mm.
But this isn't just a fun fact. It's become a specific kind of marketable anchor point for her comedy.
How so? How does that work in a routine?
Well, the key thing is she talks about it. She's explicitly brought this, yeah, kind of absurd family link into her stand-up.
Okay, so how does that land comedically? Taking this figure of, like, ultimate, wholesome, mid-century entertainment and mixing it with modern personal stand-up.
It works on a few levels, I think. First, it instantly helps define her character, right? She's this comic from Fargo, she has the accent, and boom, this relationship immediately grounds her in this specific regional past. It's kind of dorky, but it's also deeply authentic.
Right, it adds a layer.
Yeah, and second, it creates this great comedic juxtaposition. You know, she could be talking about something totally contemporary, like dating apps or whatever, and then she drops the name Lawrence Welk, this figure of almost unbelievable wholesomeness.
It highlights the gap between her life and maybe what you'd expect from that family history.
Exactly. It's self-deprecating, but it's also tied to her real heritage. It gives the audience this unique hook, something specific to remember her by, and it really leans into the idea that her comedy is hers. It could only come from this particular, slightly quirky Fargo family background.
It really shows she's not afraid to use every part of her own story, no matter how unusual. So for you, the listener, right away, this tells you something important. We're dealing with a comic whose material comes from these super specific personal details. And often, that's the kind of comedy that really connects.
And that focus on the personal, it leads us right into talking about her actual comedic voice. She started building this right after college, and the sources are really clear. The material is personal, but the delivery is rooted in place.
So what are the key things you'd hear in an Amber Preston set? What makes it hers?
Well, the first thing is just the sound. Her routines really feature her distinct Upper Midwest accent. It's central. And her Fargo upbringing is this constant theme, this backdrop.
And it's not just about sounding authentic, is it?
No, it's more than that. It's like signaling her identity, her perspective. The accent itself can be part of the humor. For a national audience, maybe it sounds inherently funny in a way, but for people from the region, it's relatable. She's basically highlighting these regional quirks.
And nothing shows the specificity, the detail in her material, quite like the example the sources give about her New Kids on the Block fandom and KOTB.
Oh yeah, this isn't just like, hey, remember the 90s. This goes deep.
Really deep.
It's like comedic obsession level deep. We know she doesn't just mention the band. She actually sometimes reads out loud on stage from this specific series of novels from the early 90s, where the new kids are having adventures, like in the style of the Hardy Boys.
Okay, stop right there. That is amazing.
Isn't it? Think about the layers. It's almost like archival comedy. She's digging up this piece of genuinely forgotten 90s pop culture artifact. This book series written just to cash in on teen obsession.
And she performs it seriously.
Well, maybe seriously is comedy. She's relying on the audience, you know, to get the sheer absurdity of that cultural moment. She's basically saying, look what we loved. Look at this thing we consumed.
That's brilliant. But doesn't focusing on something that niche, like NKOTB adventure novels, doesn't that risk maybe losing some of the audience, making it too small?
You'd think so, maybe. But I think the risk is lessened by her authenticity and just the performance itself. Really great comedy often finds something universal in the extremely specific, right?
Yeah, that's true.
She's not just talking about NKOTB. She's talking about, like, the intensity of being a teenager, how earnest that pop culture was, how time passes. The novel is just the vehicle for that.
And the vulnerability of admitting you loved this slightly embarrassing thing.
Exactly. That vulnerability connects. And honestly, it takes guts to bring actual props, like old books, onto a comedy stage.
Yeah, no kidding. And this unique style, this voice she was building, it started getting her real recognition regionally, even years before she made the LA move.
For sure. Back in 2011, City Pages, which is a big deal in the Twin Cities art scene, they named her one of the top 100 creative people in Minneapolis. That's major local validation.
Huge.
But maybe even more important for her career path was winning that competition in 2011, the Best of the Midwest competition at Gilda's Laugh Fest. That's in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Wait, that one's so critical.
Because, well, the Midwest comedy scene is massive.
Yeah.
Winning that contest basically signals to everyone, agents, bookers, other comics, that you've kind of conquered the regional circuit. You're ready for the next step. It was like her regional diploma.
And we can see the immediate effect, because the sources point out she was actually performing at that Laugh Fest when she got her first big national break, her first appearance on WTF with Marc Maron in 2012.
The timing is perfect, right?
Yeah.
That connection is clear.
Yeah.
And she kept competing, too.
Yeah.
She was a finalist in 2012 at the Great American Comedy Festival.
Mm-hmm.
That one's held in Norfolk, Nebraska, Johnny Carson's hometown.
Wow. So placing there connects her to this bigger history of American comedy.
Definitely. And it showed she could hold her own outside her Minneapolis base.
But the really big national stamp of approval, that came even earlier, didn't it? 2011, from Marc Maron himself.
Yeah, Maron named her one of his five top comedians to watch very early in her career. That kind of endorsement, well, it opens doors.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
And we even have the quote, what he said about her.
Yeah, Maron called her a brassy gal who could play a one-nighter at a bowling alley or a thousand-seat theater and just nail it.
That quote says so much, doesn't it, about her versatility, her toughness.
Totally. It highlights someone whose act works anywhere. She doesn't need fancy production or a specific type of room. The material and her presence are strong enough. She's a road comic, a true professional, a comic's comic.
Okay, so now we get to that core puzzle, the contradiction we need to really unpack.
Right.
Maron, the ultimate comedy insider, he's hyping her in 2011, top talent. Then 7 years fly by, it's 2018, and Thrillist, the entertainment website, names her one of the best undiscovered comedians in America.
Yeah.
How does that work? How are you a top proven talent, but still undiscovered almost a decade later?
This is such a key lesson in how the modern comedy business works, I think. It just highlights the massive difference between industry recognition and actual mainstream visibility.
Okay, explain that.
Maron's praise meant the people inside comedy knew her. The other comics, the bookers, the club owners, they respected her. She'd paid her dues, won the right contest, toured, built the act.
Right, known within the scene.
Exactly. But Thrillist,
Yeah.
they're writing for a much broader audience, people who mostly find out about entertainment through, online lists, mainstream websites, social media.
So undiscovered basically meant she hadn't broken through that next level of mainstream amplification yet. Like she didn't have the big late night set or a recurring role on a sitcom or the huge Netflix special deal.
Precisely. The label isn't really a critique of her talent at all.
Right.
It's just a reflection of her market penetration at that point. It shows just how crowded and tough the entertainment world is.
Yeah.
You can be championed by the absolute best, have a killer act, and still spend years kind of flying under the radar for the average person.
But the fact she was still making those kinds of lists in 2018, that also says something positive, right?
Oh, absolutely. It confirms her quality was consistent. She didn't disappear. She had the stamina, the persistence to keep working through those years it took to bridge that gap between the industry buzz and real commercial breakthrough.
And that stamina, that consistency, it really did pay off commercially with her debut album, Sparkly Parts. Let's get into that. Released April 17, 2020, Stand Up Records.
Right. And we know she'd built the fan base, the reputation over years, but the success was immediate and really significant.
How significant?
It debuted at number one on both the Amazon and the iTunes comedy charts.
Wow, both.
Both. Now, that tells you more than just, oh, she has some loyal fans. It shows that all that groundwork, the regional touring, but also crucially, all that digital outreach, we'll talk more about it, had built a big enough network. People who were ready and waited to buy her stuff the second it dropped.
That first week's surge is what gets you to number one.
Exactly. That immediate buy-in.
But the timing here is wild. April 2020.
Yeah. Right as the world was basically locking down,
Yeah.
coronavirus quarantine hitting hard.
So no big album release party at a comedy club.
Nope. Couldn't happen.
Yeah.
So she had to pivot instantly, which really shows that, necessity breeds invention in comedy too.
What did she do?
Instead of the usual club show, she live streamed a comedy set right from her home.
Smart.
Really smart. It not only marked the album release, but it also gave people stuck at home some much needed timely entertainment. Great timing in a weird way.
And the reviews backed up the sales numbers.
They did. Richard Lanois over at the Serious Comedy site, he reviewed Sparkly Parts and called it a hoot to listen to. And this part is key. He said it had no weak moments.
No weak moments. That points back to all those years of work, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's the payoff of that long regional development. By the time she recorded that first album, she had road tested every single joke. Dozens, probably hundreds of times. First in Minneapolis, then nationally in LA and on tour.
So the quality wasn't some accident, it was earned.
Totally earned. The product of just relentless consistency and editing down to the best stuff.
Now, besides her own solo work, Preston seems really involved in the community side of comedy too, especially out in LA.
Yeah, she co-hosts this weekly showcase at the Hollywood Improv. It's called Punchline Punchout.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, first off, she co-hosts it with another fantastic comic, Andy Erickson, who is, fittingly, Also, a Minnesota transplant.
Ah, keeping the Midwest connection strong in LA.
Seems like it. And the show itself, the format, it sounds intense. It's designed to keep comics sharp. It runs like a game show. Comics get just 10 minutes, apparently, to come up with punchlines really fast, all based on a specific topic they're given.
Wow, 10 minutes. That's pressure.
High pressure. It forces quick thinking, improvisation mixed with structured writing. It's like essential training for any working comic. You know, it keeps you from just getting stuck doing the same old material over and over. It's constant agility practice.
Makes sense. Keeps the writing muscles flexed.
Exactly. And doing that collaboration with another comic from back home right in the middle of Hollywood, it just reinforces that regional bond, that shared viewpoint. Probably influences the whole vibe of their show.
And she's branched out beyond just stand-up too, right? The sources mention acting, film work, trying to diversify.
Yeah, definitely making moves there. She starred in a short film in 2019 called The Poacher.
Okay. Did it get seen anywhere?
It did, yeah. It had a pretty decent festival run. Played at the Culver City Film Festival and the Yucca Valley Film Festival in 2019. Then in 2020, it screened at the Los Angeles Short Film Festival.
So respectable indie festivals.
Exactly. And that's important because this shows she's not just like waiting for her stand-up fame to maybe get her an acting gig. She's actively going out and getting roles in projects that are getting critical attention on the festival circuit. It helps broaden her profile from just comedian to, you know, versatile performer within that LA industry machine.
Okay, this section feels absolutely crucial to understanding how Sparkly Parts hit number one, her podcast history. It's extensive.
Oh, it's huge. And looking at the list, it's not just, oh, she did some podcasts. It's like a strategic roadmap. It shows exactly how she built her network, raised her profile over years, using the digital space almost like a second stage.
It's the modern comedian's playbook, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you're not constantly on the road, you're constantly on podcasts, or both.
Right.
And these appearances, they work on so many levels. They're promo for her live shows, for the album eventually. They're networking, connecting with other comics, hosts. And they're a way to actually workshop material, especially the really niche stuff, for audiences who might specifically get it.
And the biggest connection, the one that really tracks her career arc, is Marc Maron's podcast, WTF. She was on three separate times.
Three times, which is significant in itself on a show that big. Let's look at the timeline again because it tells the story.
Okay, first time. Episode 292 back in 2012, recorded live at Gilda's Laugh Fest.
Right. Right when she was winning awards, getting that first wave of critical buzz, that appearance was basically Maron telling the national comedy audience, hey, pay attention to this person. It put her on the map for listeners outside the Midwest.
Then fast forward 3 years, 2015, episode 576.
And this one was different. It was a multi-guest episode. She's on there with huge names, Whitney Cummings, Pamela Adlon, Shelby Farrow.
Wow, that's heavy company.
Right. Being included in that lineup, that's validation from her peers. It shows she's now seen as a respected working comic, operating at a high level within that LA scene. It's industry acceptance.
And then the third time, episode 1132, June 2020.
Perfect timing. Just after Starkly Parts dropped.
Using Maron's massive platform to push the album.
Exactly. That's the commercial payoff appearance. Okay. So just tracking those three WTF episodes, you get this clear narrative. Discovery, peer respect, and then commercial launch. It shows this ongoing relationship with one of comedy's biggest platforms and how she used it strategically at each key stage.
But it wasn't just the huge shows like WTF. Her strategy seems much deeper, going on to niche podcasts too.
This is where you see the real planning, I think. She used these smaller, more focused podcasts to really dig into her specific material, like that NKOTB stuff.
Right. You mentioned she did a whole episode about that.
Yeah, on Obsessed with Joseph Scrimshaw, 2016, episode 92. The entire episode was focused specifically on her new Kids on the Block material.
That's brilliant targeting.
Isn't it? It's not just general promotion. It's finding the exact audience that's already primed to love that specific slice of pop culture history she's mining for comedy. It let her go way deeper into the bit than she probably could in a typical 15-minute club set.
And she did Jackie Cashin's show, too, The Dork Forest.
Yes, in 2015, live from the Bridgetown Comedy Festival. And Jackie's show is literally about people's specific, often nerdy obsessions. So again, a perfect fit for someone whose signature bit involves reading from obscure 90s boy band novels.
It shows she knew where her material would resonate most strongly.
Totally. And she even showed some versatility by going on probably science in 2015.
That's a comedy show about science.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Comics riffing on science news. Appearing on that suggests her humor isn't just based on telling personal stories. She also has the quick wit, the smarts, to hang in a conversation about, you know, current events and science. It signals adaptability to bookers and listeners. She's not a one-trick pony.
And the rest of the list just shows this was ongoing, consistent work. Shows like Stuffed Animal Party way back in 2013. Later on, things like Magnetronic, Lady to Lady, somewhere right up near the album release in early 2020.
Year after year of engagement. That digital space, it really was her second touring circuit and probably her main marketing engine. She was building connections, building trust, creating anticipation with literally thousands of listeners across all these different shows and niches.
So when Sparkly Parts finally came out,
those thousands of listeners who felt like they knew her voice, her specific stories, they were ready to click buy. Her success wasn't some overnight viral thing. It was the direct result of years, almost a decade, of consistent, maybe low-key, but very strategic digital outreach. Hashtag digital outro.
So looking back at the whole picture, we've really traced Amber Preston's path from, you know, that Fargo high school grad related to Lawrence Welk, using her accent as part of her act in Minneapolis, all the way to being this chart-topping comic based in L.A., getting nods from the biggest names in the business. It's a really powerful story of just sticking with it and staying true to your specific voice.
Absolutely. I think what her career really demonstrates is the incredible power of consistency, but consistency mixed with that super personal, super specific material. She never tried to hide or sand off the edges, the regional stuff, the dorky stuff like NKOTB, the Welk thing.
Just leaned into it.
Totally leaned into it. And she combined that unique vulnerability with just relentless hard work. The competitions like Gilda's Laugh Fest, the film projects, being part of the scene with shows like Punchline, Punchout. It was all part of the build.
And managing to hit number one with Sparkly Parts right in the middle of a global pandemic, pivoting immediately to that live stream release, it just proves, you know, if the material's tight and the network's been built and the timing hits, the comic who can adapt, they win.
She was ready. She'd done the work, built the audience, and that audience, stuck at home, was probably desperate for exactly the kind of authentic, funny escape she offered.
Yeah.
And that brings us to maybe the final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. Think again about those two labels.
Yeah.
Top comedian to watch in 2011 from Marin the Insider, and then undiscovered comedian from Thrillist in 2018, aimed at the mainstream.
Right, the talent was clearly there all along. The visibility was the variable.
Exactly. So what does that gap really tell us about how we measure success now? Is real national recognition maybe measured less by who the traditional gatekeepers say is good, and more by stuff you can actually count? Like hitting number one on iTunes, which means the audience directly voted with their wallets.
Direct engagement versus critical acclaim.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Is that the new metric? And thinking about her foundation, how she turned that very specific Fargo Midwest identity into a national asset, it makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Wonder what?
Well, what other regional voices are out there right now? Comics in, I don't know, Boise or Austin or rural Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Who are mastering their own specific niche, building their own digital network quietly, just waiting for that perfect moment to drop their album, make their pivot, and maybe surprise everyone by hitting the top of the charts too. Who's next to bridge that gap?